That's it.
Good afternoon. Today is Wednesday, April 1st, and this is the Senate Public Safety Budget Division meeting. We have three bills on the agenda today, and then we're going to do a little discussion about the policy bill that is coming to us from the Judiciary Policy Committee. First up today, we have Senate File 1219, Senator Resk's bill about licensing standards for firefighters.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1219 that came to you from the Judiciary Committee was a bill that proposed to license full-time firefighters, and the licensing authority being the Department of Public Safety. Although the bill was passed here, there were concerns raised about appropriate ways to include volunteer firefighters in the licensing discussion. And so in working with all the interested parties, we have developed a delete everything amendment that I would like to explain and then I hope would be adopted by the committee. The delete everything amendment, which is the A2 amendment, first of all, continues to require full-time firefighters to be licensed by July 1st of 2011, but it is permissive with regard to volunteer firefighters. If a volunteer firefighter chooses to be licensed, they may be subject to the continuing firefighter education requirements that the full-time firefighters would have as well. The Fire Training and Education Board would do the licensing. The license would be good for 3 years at $75. That does not change, except the issuing authority was changed from the Department of Public Safety to the Fire Training and Education Board. There is a prior appointment provision, and that covers all firefighters, both full-time and volunteers. We tried to get away from the term grandfathering or grandparenting, but that is the common term for what we allow at that point. There is a continuing firefighter education requirement for licensure, which requires 24 hours per year for training purposes. In addition, another concern that was raised in the Judiciary Committee is that there was no provision for revocation of a license once granted, and that that is also in the Delete Everything Amendment in Subdivision 8. With regard to how a license is obtained, and again, this would apply to everyone except those that have had prior appointments. To obtain a license, an individual must receive accredited training at a school or program approved by the board, attend a skills training course, pass a certification test, and in a sense, it's an initial one. It's in a process similar to obtaining a driver's license. The only difference really is that with a firefighter being relicensed, they would need to have the 24 hours per year of the CFE. The expectation is that 2,000 licenses will be issued by July 1st, 2011, which reflects the full-time firefighters, and of the 18,000 volunteer firefighters, a reasonable estimate may be that another 2,000 will seek a license. If this bill becomes law, it would be the first licensing for firefighters in the country. And we have people here to respond to questions. As far as I know now, there is only support for the bill, and the issues that were raised by volunteer firefighters have been addressed in the delete all amendment. And as the chair knows, there are savings in this bill, and she and I have discussed that it would be more appropriate to keep the bill in the committee as part of your omnibus bill so that the savings would accrue to the Public Safety Finance Division and not be lost in the great unknown of the of the full Finance Committee, and I am perfectly agreeable with that.
Thank you, Senator Rust. Is everybody comfortable with the changes from the first engrossment to the A2? Senator Mouat was your committee. All right. Senator wants to move the A2 amendment. Mm-hmm. Senator Ingridson moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion? All in favor of adopting the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Adopted. Mr. Thornburg, Mr. Rice, do you have anything that you want to add to our committee?
We don't have.
Do you just want to answer questions?
Just answer questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom Thornburg, President, Minnesota Professional Firefighters, members of the committee. We need this bill. This is important. Since being elected president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters, I've had a chance to get around the state to the career firefighters, to my locals, my members. And the amount of training really varies greatly from city to city. And from zero training in one city in particular that I know of, I'm not going to name names, to very good training in other cities. This bill would provide that a firefighter would have at least a minimal amount of training before actually going in and fighting fires and doing the work that we do. I believe this is very important, and it's probably long overdue. And I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Thornburg. Any questions? Senator Ingridson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions, and maybe the senator could answer or whatever with regards to Section 2.
Excuse me.
I'm sorry, page 2.
The delete everything amendment?
Yes, subdivision 8. The petty misdemeanor discharge. I'm wondering why that's there versus just, termination.
Senator Betzel. Madam Chair, that was...
Senator Betzel.
Senator Betzel added that as an amendment in the Judiciary Committee, and it was an attempt to make sure that people present themselves as licensed firefighters, that they are held accountable for that. And if they represent themselves as something else, that they would be discharged from their employment.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Follow up, the other question I would have with regards to the first testifier. You say we need this. Is this going to benefit business within the jurisdiction of the licensed fire departments, licensed personnel? What I mean by that
I'd like to respond to that.
Okay.
I think when we set minimum standards, the expectation in that for a profession or an occupation, and in this case public safety professionals, that the communities then, and all people in the communities, businesses, local governments, individuals, have a certain set of expectations for that provision, for that profession or that occupation. And this, and by setting minimum standards, that's the expectation that the community and businesses can have.
Mr. Rice.
Madam Chair, Brian Rice, attorney for the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. I think really looking at this committee, Senator Ingridson, you were kind enough to spend some time with me talking about the bill, as was Senator Foley, but obviously you were in a former life Sheriff Ingridson, and Senator Foley was Colonel Foley with the Highway Patrol, and you were both, not to disclose your age too much, but when you entered the profession several decades ago, there was no licensing, and I think probably you two are probably in some of the best positions to attest to what it meant to licensed police officers in the state and where I think that's led that profession.
It's benefited.
Benefited. I think it's raised the bar, the communities, the standards, professional conduct. And just one other point, Senator, after the Judiciary Committee hearing, there was some question about making sure that we did add a provision right at the very end of the bill about revocation, that the Fire Training Board would have the ability, like the Post Board, if there's egregious misconduct on the behalf of a firefighter that goes to that job, the Fire Training Board could revoke a license as well.
Senator Rose?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
set it to rest on subdivision 2, page 3, under section 4. The volunteer firefighter may receive or apply for a licensure. Can you give me a reason why they would want to do that? There, is there a financial incentive or some?
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, it may be that a volunteer firefighter wants to have the license because they may want to seek employment as a full-time firefighter, and this would, this licensing would give them that standard. It may be also the case that eventually all volunteer firefighters might want to have the same kind of licensing as well, even though they are not full-time. So we are bringing them in as a permissive. If they want to present themselves even as a volunteer firefighter with the same minimum standards of training that the full-time firefighters have going forward, that they would be able to do that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rest, and I appreciate that you did not make it mandatory, because
right.
in my Senate district, I don't believe I have a full-time firefighter.
Yes. Well, there are 18,000 volunteers,
right.
So they are by far the greatest number of people who are protecting our lives and doing emergency medical services, which is what more and more firefighters are called upon to provide emergency medical services than they are actually fighting fires, although we have seen in the last couple of months, at least in the metropolitan area, some very significant fires that firefighters have been involved in.
Let's go ahead. And Senator Rest, and that's the point I'm trying to make, is that in my Senate district, they are having a hard time getting volunteer firefighters. They
mm-hmm.
have been up talking about that issue. I think the bill is very good. I just want to make sure that we don't require them to get
no.
a licensure, because that is one more strike against the campaign.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, no. It, for the volunteers, it's voluntary.
Great. Thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I hope you didn't misunderstand me when I asked the question about what benefits. Obviously, we're going to benefit by having licensed firemen. I certainly understand it. My question was, it should have been a little more clear. Are the businesses in the jurisdictions are going to benefit by having professional firemen? That I understand. Are they going to benefit by a lower insurance rate? Has that been talked about or thought about? That's what I meant.
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, I hadn't even thought of that, but it might well be, once the program is established, that insurance companies will take that into consideration.
Madam Chair, if I could offer a comment on that. Right now in the state, you spend $400 per police officer a year in training. And it's, for police officers, it's $400 a year for training for police officers, and you get a really good product, I think. For firefighters, it's 40. One-tenth of the amount, and that's an issue that this committee has with the fire safety training account. This was a bill that Senator Rest carried a few years back to set up the fire training board and provide money for it. Minnesotans really get a great deal when it comes to firefighting. We're 47th out of 50 states in our expenditures per capita on firefighting. A lot of it is because it is done by volunteers, but as Senator Rosen points out, it's getting harder and harder to find those volunteers as the workforce ages, as two income families is their time to do it. And I think, to answer your question, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think with more training of firefighters and more professionalism in the area, that you're going to find more schools offering programs. There's going to be a greater need for training. I think the science of firefighting should advance like it has in police officers. I mean, Minnesota is really kind of a mecca in best practices for police officer training, because 30 years ago the legislature had the wisdom to license police officers, and from that kind of grew a cottage industry of community colleges, two-year AA degrees, four-year degrees in police science, and I think it's really raised the bar in this state on professionalism, and we've really, it was a very wise decision, you know, a generation ago to do that to police, and I'd hope to live long enough to say that what this committee is doing with this bill will have a similar effect on fire signs.
Thank you. Just to follow up, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of interest. I just know that if you're within a certain jurisdiction of a certain fire department, you get a reduced rate closer. And I'm just wondering too, if in the future having a licensed unit like that would benefit. So I'm just throwing that out.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Madam Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Senator Rest or Mr. Rice, maybe starting on line 311 and going to 312. What are we notwithstanding? And can I take that little sentence out or that part of a sentence out? In general, those notwithstanding anything under the sun things kind of lose their effectiveness after a certain point. Mr. Rice?
Madam Chair, I think it's probably the lawyer in me since I was the primary drafter of this, although I did work extensively with Mr. Steve Noss of the revisor's office. I think the question would be that since you're licensing, you want to kind of preempt anything out there that's out in the field, and it's a statement to say that from this time forward, full-time firefighters will be required to have a license. So it's kind of the cover all your bases.
Superseding any charter.
Yeah, any local charter or ordinance.
Don't we, as the legislature, supersede charter?
Not always.
Anyway?
In the case of home rule charters, you would not.
Right.
If a city has a home rule charter, they could, might be able to claim that they have the general permission under the state constitution to make their own laws with respect to certain things in their jurisdiction. But it's I guess I would say it's probably more a convention.
Could we at least do not getting rid of any general or local law or, and then make it notwithstanding any charter provision to the contrary?
I might rely more on your Senate counsel if they've got some suggestion on that.
What do you think? Is there a way to...
Madam Chair, members, if you want to do what you were suggesting, you would provide us with notwithstanding any local charter to the contrary. I'm not in any way an expert in local ordinances or charter provisions. So if you wanted to leave just that, you would just say notwithstanding any local charter to the contrary.
A charter provision, I think it would have to be. People comfortable with making that change? Senator Rosen moves.
Yep.
Senator Rest, you okay with that?
As long as a local ordinance wouldn't have precedence either. That's all. I don't know that it would, but sometimes we do it the other way around. Notwithstanding a general law, a local ordinance takes precedence. So I don't know whether you need to do that the other way around.
This is going to be held over for inclusion in the omnibus bill. We'll do a little checking and we'll figure out what the right language is.
That'd be great.
When we work on it for that, we'll have it figured out.
That'd be fine.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Just another follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to make it clear, we have some medium-sized fire department. I think one in my district would be Alexandria. Would be the biggest one. They have, I think, maybe one or two full-time fire department folks there. Are they going to be required to then become a member of this?
If they're full-time, first of all, their prior appointment automatically licenses them. And so the fire chiefs, for example, would be grandfathered in as fully licensed. But then following that, they all have to take have that 24 hours a year of continuing firefighter education and training. So your fire chief would certainly have to have that.
Aren't we talking about full, excuse me, Madam Chair.
Go right ahead.
Aren't we talking about full-time employment? Are we talking full-time employment? Our fire chiefs are not fully full-time employed.
Well, I thought you were indicating that your fire chief was a full.
No, there's a couple.
That you had a couple of full-time
There would be two other
people.
Than the chief. I'm sorry. I should have cleared that
I'm sorry. Anyone who is full-time.
Employed
needs to be licensed. If they are currently full-time employed, they are grandfathered in with regard to the requirements. But then starting with that licensure, which would be going forward from 2011, they would need to have the, when they're relicensed, they would need to have the continuing firefighter education to gain the relicensure.
Okay.
And 24 hours a year is I think, a reasonable amount. I know other professions and occupations require far more hours of continuing education to maintain the license.
Senator Rest, in our packets we have a copy of the fiscal note. Does the A2 amendment make any changes in the fiscal aspect of this bill?
Madam Chair, if anything, I would think it involves additional savings. But I would hope that when you if you act favorably on the bill and put it in your omnibus bill, that there will be a revised fiscal note that would show that.
Mr. Rice?
Madam Chair, on page 2 of 3, whoever did this fiscal note, I think, is really sharp. There are 1,600 full-time firefighters in the state, unionized firefighters that Mr. Thornburg represents, and our estimate was there was another 400 chiefs, assistant chiefs, or fire marshals. Perhaps, as Senator Ingebretson said, there might be a couple full-time chiefs. So that would be our estimate of the 2,000 that's in this fiscal note. Senator Rest's testimony was that there are 18,000 volunteers, and our guess, and it's simply a guess, probably Mr. Turner, who's ever doing the work on it, might want to make some inquiries. We would guess there might be another 2,000 volunteers that would seek licensure, and they would probably be perhaps people in the metropolitan area that are, or in these other cities that are trying to get on a department full-time, or they are perhaps members of a volunteer department that aspire to be a chief or get a full-time job, and there might be some incentive for them to say, I'm working in this area, I want to make a career out of it. If I can get a license, I'll be able to present myself and say that I'm ready, willing, and able to move up. So that's our guess, but obviously your staff, I think, might want to do some work on those assumptions. It's nothing more than a guesstimate, but it's maybe reasonable guesstimate.
All right. Thank you. Are there any other questions on this bill? Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Rest, the 24 hours of education and training, are they being paid for that? And who would be paying for that, the county or the
Senator Rest?
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, from the outset, it would be the individual's responsibility, but it may also be that their employer decides that that is a valuable benefit to the department and find funds to help them. But it is the individual's responsibility.
I think Mr. Thornburg might have.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I've worked for Minneapolis Fire Department. I've worked there for 30 years, and we far in Minneapolis, and I know that all of my members far exceed 24 hours of training per year, and typically that training is done on duty. We train just about every single day.
Madam Chair, I think to amplify that point, I think what the legislature did with Senator Rest's bill, and was it 2006, Senator?
Mm-hmm.
Set up the fire training board, and this board is in now developing the protocols and certifying trainers and bringing it out throughout the state. A lot of it is going into greater Minnesota and the smaller departments, because big departments like Minneapolis and St. Paul, Coon Rapids and others have an institutional history of doing this, but they're now rolling out the training to other departments. And so it really, I think, this licensure requirement will now, I think, accelerate that process, because people will have to have programs. They'll, you know, standardize programs to roll out. There's resources now. Hopefully this committee will be kind to the fire safety account and allow the firefighters to go from $40 to maybe somewhere closer to the police to have this training be readily available and paid for by the state. So it's not going to be just all local mandate. There is this pot of money with the fire training account to do the training, to get grants available so departments can come in and get people trained and up to speed and on the current fire safety issues.
But the responsibility is, the bill is silent on that.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. And I know the big fire departments offer their resources to the small departments around the state as well. The fire training towers and things are used by the small communities as well. The one up not far from my house is, I know. All right. Is there Senator Rosen?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move that Senate file 1219 as amended be recommended to pass and we refer to.
Well, we're just going to lay it over for consideration in the omnibus bill. On that motion, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you all very much.
Sure.
The next bill is Senator Moy's bill, Restoring Civil Rights. It's going to be great.
Madam Chair, I'd like to present to you Senate File 564, which is the restoration of voting rights upon release from incarceration. The bill came to you because the bill, as amended in a number of the committees, carried with it potential fiscal notes. But I believe that those issues have been resolved, Madam Chair. So the fiscal note that was attached to the bill from the Supreme Court has been resolved. There are no costs to the Supreme Court. And what is and the rest of the other costs to corrections and the Secretary of State's office will be addressed by the by HAVA funds that are available for the database for data sharing to take place. There is only one additional cost of, I believe, $25,000 to the Secretary of State's office for printing of new voter registration cards with the new language attesting that the individual has been convicted of a felony but meets the proper requirement because they have been discharged from incarceration. We have the A6 Amendment, Madam Chair, language which we've worked out with the Secretary of State's office so that they're able to use up the remainder of the voter registration cards that they have, and the new language of attestation will go on the new batch of cards that they will be printing. The A6 Amendment, in addition to addressing that cost factor, also with recommendation from counsel and feedback from the Secretary of State's office, is making some technical changes to make sure that we are referring to the restoration of the voting rights of the individual and not confuse it with the restoration of civil rights, which may be other rights that we're not intending to address in this bill. So, Madam Chair, the essence of the bill is that we are asking, we're changing what is in current law. Current law in Minnesota, from a policy standpoint, allows the individual to have their voting rights restored after they've been, quote-unquote, off papers. What this bill does is that it says that the individual will be eligible to vote when they're once they have been discharged from incarceration. The A6 Amendment makes it very specific that being discharged from incarceration does not include being on work release or being furloughed. So you would have to be discharged from incarceration. And this is the policy piece that has made it through the policy committee, and the A6 Amendment just wants to make it very clear that we are not intending to for this to cover people on work release or furlough. But Madam Chair, that's the A6 Amendment, and I believe that that takes care of all the fiscal issues that are implicated in the bill.
Thank you. Senator Moy, can you tell us what the requirements for the Department of Corrections are that would change with this bill?
The Department of Corrections have basically, I believe, two obligations. One obligation is that the Department of Corrections have reporting a reporting relationship with the Secretary of State's office, and that reporting mechanism will have to change. How they report and how they track will have to change. They'll have to deal with their computer software to be able to communicate with the Secretary of State's office. I believe it is in that piece that some of the HAVA funds will cover that cost. They're going to do an interagency agreement to cover that cost. The second piece is that the Department of Corrections will have to, we're asking the Department of Corrections to, upon discharge, along with the other batches of information that they give to the ex-offender, that they that they also give them a notice provision to say that Minnesota allows you to have your voting rights restored to you now that you are discharged from incarceration. It is our understanding from the department that that requirement does not impose any additional responsibility or cost because it merely is a notice provision that they will be able to carry out in their usual course of the work that they do with the offenders anyways. I believe those are the only two. There, and if I have left anything out, I think that Ms. Cox is here and she could chime in. But
okay, right. And she's shaking her head that
right.
She has nothing to add at this point. Okay, any questions at this point, Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Yes, a couple of questions. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you made it very clear, Senator, that the rights restored are just pertaining to voting and not being able to possess a gun.
That's correct.
Okay. What numbers are we talking about? And my other question would be is, have you done a research as to how many other states have participated in this process?
Yes.
Like she has.
Madam Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, right now there are 14 other states that are already in the position where Minnesota wants to move to. Some of those states are actually some of our neighbors, Michigan, North Dakota, and South Dakota, among, you know, are three of these 14 states that are restricting the right to vote for inmates only. So it's not that unusual. Incidentally, there are 17 states that fall in the category that Minnesota is in under current law. So the, you know, the numbers aren't, we're moving from one of the 17th to be the number 15th in the other category.
There are, Senator Waugh, what, two states, I believe, where you don't lose to the right to vote even while you're incarcerated?
Yes, and that's in Maine and Vermont.
In Vermont. Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Yeah, just a follow-up question as to how many per year are we going to be talking about new voters are going to be coming into the
introduce
system?
Introduce yourself for the record. Mm-hmm.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Maurer-Jones with Take Action Minnesota. And there currently are about 65,000 Minnesotans who are unable to vote in the state. And so this would this change would restore the right to vote of about 45,000 of those. So it's about 75% of the people who are ineligible are currently out of incarceration.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
And to make that clear, that's felons only, right? That's not misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor.
That's correct, Madam Chair, because under current law, we only restrict felons from their right to vote until they've been off papers.
Right.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, Senator Moab, what is the normal length of time between the release out of incarceration to the notice of restoration of civil rights? What is the length of time there?
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, are you referring to current law?
Current law.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, it sometimes depends on what your conviction was. And sometimes, I mean, you have to be, current law requires you to have to be off paper. So you have to finish whatever community supervision period that you're under. And sometimes, you know, I don't know, maybe it depends on whatever the crime is. And Mr. Backus maybe could tell us. It could be anywhere from, I don't know, 3 to 5 years to like 10, 20 years. I don't know what the longest length that people are on community supervision for, but
long time.
Okay. Any other questions? And so, Senator Waugh, the fiscal note that we have with the changes that you've made and the agreements that will be made with Department of Corrections and Secretary of State's office would mean that there is no fiscal effect for our division.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Funds, which are federal funds, will take care of the funding needed in Secretary of State's office.
Madam Chair, and in fact, before the A6 amendment, there was no cost impact for your division. What the A6 amendment took care of was the cost to the Secretary of State's office, and that would have had us going from you to the State and Local Government Budget Division, but I was notified by Senator Betzel's office that if the A6 amendment went on the bill, taking away that cost, that they don't need to see it. And I guess from here, you would just send me to the full finance committee to confirm with a new fiscal note that there are no other costs.
That reminds us we should adopt the A6 amendment. Would you? Senator Moi moves the A6 amendment. All in favor of adopting the A6 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay. Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question is to Mr. Jones. Is that correct? Usually when bills come forward, either from constituents or groups, something is of disarray, or something needs to be fixed, or something's broken. Obviously, can you give me a little background as to why this is brought forward? I mean, is there a lot of concerns about those that are still locked up in prison on not having the rights to vote? Or give me some flavor for that, would you,
Mr. Mauer Jones?
Senator Ingebretson, members of the committee. So my organization has a pretty long history of working on issues of trying to make it more accessible and easier for people to participate. We work with people in the community all the time, and any of you who've door knocked probably have run into people who do not know that they have their right to vote restored at all in Minnesota. And the other reason for this change is that we believe really that once people have been asked to rejoin society, that our correction system has said you're ready to be released and go back to the community, that people should get a say in what goes on in the community. And so it would also make it a simpler system to notify people when once you're out of prison, then you can vote again, rather than at some distant time in the future when there isn't very good notification of that process.
Senator Moore.
Madam Chair and Senator Ingebretson, I apologize that I didn't have my testifier who came to both of the State and Local Government Policy Committee and the Judiciary Policy Committee here. But he was somebody who went through the process, was discharged from incarceration, and had been off papers. And he didn't know that he could vote until this year, this past year, when he was informed of that. And just to hear him speak with such pride about being able to vote, and really on behalf of our ex-offenders who are now re-entering the community and becoming part of the society, they feel that being able to exercise that right is one form of having them feel like they're anchored to the community, and to be able to exercise that civil right, I think emotionally and psychologically is a reminder and affirmation that they're critical, productive members of the community. And there's been research. I also, in the policy committees, have a sociologist from the University of Minnesota who've done extensive research in this area. And it does show that in some of the studies that they've done, allowing the restoration of the right to vote upon the completion of incarceration does help to address the issue of recidivism, because it's addressing sort of the whole basket of reentry work that we're trying to do to re-anchor people back into the community. And I believe that that's probably, the most persuasive reason for why a number of states have moved in that direction. And it is one of the impetus as part of the whole package of reentry and second chance that I have. I felt like it was not only timely but appropriate for us to move on this bill.
Anything else? Is there anybody in the audience who wants to speak on this bill? Okay, Senator Moi moves.
Senate File 564, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the full Finance Committee.
All right. Any more discussion? Seeing none. All in favor of Senator Moi's motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair,
Thank
members.
Thank you.
Over there. That's got quite a tan there.
Yeah.
We ought to deport him.
What do you think?
Yeah.
Sick. Mr. Chair, I have Senate File 1332, and I have an A2 amendment. This is not the first committee, so let me give you some background on this bill.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair and members, this is about the Challenge Incarceration Program, or our boot camp up in Willow River. It was implemented through the Department of Corrections by legislative mandate in 1992. It has three phases. In the first phase, which takes place at Willow River or for women at the camp in Togo, eligible offenders participate in physical training, military bearing, chemical dependency treatment, education, and other programming before transitioning into the community under intensive supervision and supervised release. When the program was implemented in 1992, the legislature authorized funds for 90 beds at Willow River. This was followed in 2004 by a $350,000 bonding request to expand the facility. The legislature appropriated the full request for up to 100 more beds. In addition to expanding the bed capacity at Willow River, DOC moved women to a 24-bed facility at MCF Togo. In 2007, DOC proposed funding to expand Willow River to 180 beds, which we did, and the actual capacity is now at 162. In 2006, DOC completed a performance assessment of the Challenge Incarceration Program. Among the findings, the department stated that boot camps reduce costs by saving beds. Graduates receive a reduction in time served. Graduates have saved approximately 1,500 beds. Boot camps also reduce costs associated with recidivism. CIP reduces the odds that an offender will receive a new felony conviction by 32%. It also reduces the odds that an offender will be reincarcerated with a new crime by 35%. According to DOC's outcome evaluation, the program translated to an estimated total cost savings to be $18.1 million from fiscal year 93 through fiscal year 2002. As the chair of our division, I was really quite upset to find out that the CIP was not filled to capacity. This session, we were told in our committee that 146 of the 162 beds were being used. The DOC's 2009 report actually puts that number even lower at 105. When the state is renting beds and we've got a severe deficit, I think there's no better time than now to be ensuring that the facilities we operate are running effectively and, in the case of CIP, at capacity. Minnesota statutes 244.14 through 172 define the eligibility and non-eligibility for the Challenge Incarceration Program. The DOC further screens for program eligibility based on both mandatory and discretionary criteria. The mandatory and discretionary criteria are divided into categories, subcategories, and other qualifying factors, any of which prohibit an offender from enrolling in the program. This bill has several changes that I believe will ensure that the DOC uses and fills this excellent program. Specifically, it would require that unless a person is ineligible, we would require that the commissioner fills the CIP to capacity. I have met with the department and considered their additional criteria outside of the criteria that we have in statute, and the A2 amendment addresses some of those criteria and then deletes the section dealing with Togo, and DOC says that the Togo section would cost money, and we don't have any money. When I spoke yesterday with the Department of Corrections, they had worked over their list of disqualifying criteria and given me a new proposal. And while speaking with them, I decided that it really should be set in statute what
the criteria are for qualifications and disqualifications. And so in the A2 amendment, you will see a list of, starting on line 6, that are that would be added to the disqualifications. And at this point, I will take questions, and then at some point, if anybody else has any questions, then I'll move the A2 amendment, because I really think this is the way we need to go. This is a program that we put together in 1992 and set up the criteria for eligibility. And throughout the years, there have been other reasons and other ideas that have come forward. And now with this list, I believe we've brought it up to date, and we still will make it so that people who are not likely to be good good members of the program, or who still have significant issues, will find that they are not eligible. It still is based on first that the offender has to request to be in the program.
I see a few questions, Senator Higgins. Senator Bergman?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, on the amendment in regard to item number 9 on line 1.18 and 19, can you just explain that a little bit more?
Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, I am not sure that offenders who are in our prisons because the federal government has them there, or because they're here from another state, where they've been sentenced from another state, I don't know that we have the ability to let them out earlier through the use of the CIP. So that's why they're there. And maybe, maybe Assistant Commissioner Christ could give us more information on that. This was one of the departments.
Can I just have a follow-up question? So is the other state or the federal government paying for them?
Assistant Commissioner Christ.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, my name is David Christ. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Department of Corrections. In general, someone who is incarcerated in one of our facilities from another state or the federal government is from another state in general, they're on a swap. We might have somebody in their state. They might have somebody in our state. The cost turns out to be a wash, so no money is exchanged in that case. There's a few federal prisoners that we exchange with, and there are a few federal prisoners who are boarded in our Oak Park Heights facility, and the Federal Bureau of Prison pays us to have those guys in the facility. Senator Higgins was correct in her explanation that we just don't feel that we've got the authority to promise somebody a potential time cut if they're serving time from another jurisdiction.
Senator Berglund?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Christ, I can understand exempting people from that are here under a federal offense if the federal government's paying for them to be here. But if we are paying for them to be here, even if they're from another state, I don't understand why you can't amend those agreements to allow people from another state to be in one of these programs, being that we're, Minnesota taxpayers are paying for them. And if we find this is an acceptable means of providing them with services during their time of incarceration, why shouldn't we be able to make that decision?
Assistant Commissioner Christ.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, at times those offenders from another state are not going to reside in Minnesota after, for the most part, they're not going to reside in Minnesota after they are released. So we would prefer to save that resource for a Minnesota prisoner who's going to be released back into our community. Further, we would have to negotiate individually with each of those states whether that's a program they wanted their offender to participate in.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Crist, you're talking about it as if we're spending more money on people, and Senator Higgins is talking about it as if we are shortening the resources that we spend on people and therefore spending less money on people. And if we're paying for it, I don't understand why we couldn't get, you know, I mean, we don't have to agree to take people from other states. I mean, why can't we say we will take them, but we take them, you know, under this criteria? We have this program, and if they are eligible for the program and complete the program, that would be their incarceration. We're not obliged to sentence them for the length of time they would have been sentenced in another state.
Mr. Crist?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I believe we are obliged. If an offender is sentenced by a judge in another state and he is serving his time in Minnesota under the accords of the Interstate Compact, we are obliged to hold them according to the sentence they received in the other state.
Well, then, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Crist, we're not obliged to take them. And it sounds like they could end up costing more than people that otherwise would be sentenced in our state who are residents of our state, is what I'm understanding. Am I getting something wrong here, Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, the Interstate Compact is designed to help states resolve problems with offenders in their facilities. In general, there are three types of offenders that wind up in another state as a result of the Interstate Compact. One is an offender who is such a disciplinary problem in the state that sentenced him that they need to have him gone so that their facilities can be quieter and more orderly. Generally, if we're going to swap for somebody like that, bring somebody like that into the Minnesota system, we would attempt to send a similar kind of individual to another state. The second kind of offender that generally falls into the category is somebody that has a protective custody need that their original state can't accommodate. Perhaps the offender testified against somebody in another state, and that puts his life in jeopardy in the state in which he was sentenced. But maybe that guy can come to Minnesota and have a safer incarceration experience. Again, we would try to swap somebody to the other state who had a similar need in the Minnesota system. And then the third category of offender, which isn't used as often anymore, but still is once in a while, is an offender that has for some compassionate reason, it makes sense to swap him to another state. Perhaps he was somebody from Minnesota who was traveling in another state and got in trouble, but he's got no family, no resources in that other state. Sometimes we'll take that fellow back to Minnesota and incarcerate him and find somebody in our system who's got a similar need in another state.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Crist, I understand that the first category wouldn't be eligible for this program anyway. People in the first category. But I don't understand why people in the second two categories might not be.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, it all comes down to which jurisdiction sentenced that individual for his crime and whether or not the other jurisdiction is willing to allow them access to a time cut via a Minnesota program. That's their decision, not ours.
Well, Well, under this language, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Crist, we wouldn't allow them that option.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, I looked to Senator Higgins, but I think that would be correct.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, we're going to lay this bill over when the time comes to be included in the omnibus bill. So maybe we can do a little work on finding out how difficult it actually would be to, to make an agreement with another state on the possibility of including somebody in the CIP, and we could have an amendment at the time that we bring it up again. I think Senator Berglund brings up some very good points, and so if the Assistant Commissioner would work with us on getting us some more information, maybe we can just leave it at this point and we'll keep doing some other work.
Thank you.
Senator Rosen, you had a question?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chair. Senator Higgins, on the amendment, line 22, the medical conditions, you or Mr. Chris can mention what kind of medical conditions, dialysis, what are we talking about that would exclude them?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, we've got a list that includes a diagnosis of insulin-dependent diabetes, type 2 diabetic, on a controlled or observed medication, diagnosis of pulmonary diseases with symptomatic shortness of breath, active seizures, varieties of sickle cell disease, an individual with cardiac disease or with a pacemaker, defibrillator, or stent in place, someone diagnosed with an aneurysm, diagnosis of an active infection, either TB, HIV, hepatitis C, who are non-compliant with medication or experiencing side effects that affect their ability to perform activities of daily living, chemotherapy, hypertension with uncontrolled, unstable blood pressure, a weight of over 350 pounds, diagnosis of a gastrointestinal disease experiencing active symptoms, neurological symptoms of unstable neurological diseases that might worsen with stress or exercise, and diagnosed muscular disease or experiencing gait or balance disturbances.
I think they get the idea. Senator Rosen, the program is very physically rigorous. I remember when we went to visit a couple of years ago, maybe it's been, several of the men who talked to us said that they had lost, 40 pounds or more while they were there. But if you were physically, if you had some of these medical problems, I'm not sure it would be safe for them to be subjected to the rigors of it. So, I think we say in the amendment that the DOC, would put together a list of the conditions that would disqualify. And it sounds like they are all things that could be really tough if you were put into this kind of a camp.
Mr. Senator Rosen, do you have a follow-up?
I did, thank you. What about anything to do with mental health disease? And if there was, if they were allowed into the program, is there medical care there available? Or would they be allowed into a program like this with some kind of mental health issue?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, that was a question that I had for Senator Higgins. In the documents that we forwarded to her yesterday, we would be able to screen offenders for mental health issues that might make them inappropriate for the program. I don't see that specifically in the amendment, and I'm not sure whether that's subsumed in the medical portion that is in the amendment.
Mr. Chair and Senator, Rosen, I didn't put it in the amendment as an automatic disqualifier. There were a couple of reasons for that. Number one, we have so many people there who have some sort of diagnosed mental illness. I don't think that mental illness should automatically be a disqualifier from this program. If you are getting medication, if that's appropriate, if you're getting counseling, if that's appropriate, whatever whatever is available and they're working well, I don't see a reason that should make them disqualified at this point. And maybe Senator Berglund has more to add with that from a medical background than I know she has.
Before that, Senator Berglund, I think Assistant Commissioner Christ had something to add to that that might inform your question or comment.
Mr. Chairman, I would agree with Senator Higgins' assessment of the mental health qualifier here. We wouldn't be looking to disqualify everybody that's got a mental health issue, only the very serious ones that would prevent them from participating in the program.
Senator Berglund?
Well, I would certainly agree with that. Most people should be able to live normal lives with mental illness, and we shouldn't be discriminating against that group of people based on that, simply that diagnosis. But the issue that piqued my interest when you read the list was someone who's had a stent implanted into their heart. There are many people that have stents that are, running in, athletic events all the time. I mean, I don't think a stent would necessarily automatically disqualify you if you had a healthy heart and your blood pressure and cholesterol were being maintained.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, we are reviewing the medical criteria again. And that would be the sort of thing we might ask our medical director whether that ought to be a disqualifier. I understand the point you're making.
And, Mr.
Senator
Chairman,
Berglund.
I also have not as strong a feeling, but a similar concern about diabetes. There's many people that live with diabetes that control it very well with their insulin and are healthy otherwise. And I wouldn't think necessarily you'd want to disqualify them either. We have a pretty high percentage of our population now that has diabetes.
Senator Berglund, I see Assistant Commissioner Christ has made a few notes for follow-up on your comments. Senator Rosen?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Christ would have to do something with the stent and the diabetes. Would that have something to do with the liability, or how does that work? Is that why they were considered?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, I'm not a medical authority by any means. I would guess that it has to do with both liability and also the safety of the participant.
Interesting.
Senator Berglund?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Christ, I would maintain that someone that has had a stent put in and has had, a number of years of healthy living would be far less risky than somebody who needs to have a stent put in and hasn't had one. And you don't always know who those people are. You can't tell by looking at them. And, many times they haven't exhibited pain or had symptoms that you would know about necessarily.
Body image.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, I agree with you. Each participant does go through a medical examination before they are cleared for the program. And so I would hope that we would find that in that medical exam, but it doesn't always show up. I understand that.
Unless you're planning to do a whole body scan, you might miss some of that plaque in the arteries. Perhaps is there a possibility of waivers for people who want to participate in the program that may have some pre-existing medical conditions that would pose some risk?
Mr. Chairman, there's always that possibility. I would have to defer to our legal counsel for a better answer to that.
You could make a note on that, too, please. Appreciate it. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is it fair to say they have a medical doctor sign off on these people before they're able to participate? Is that, that's pretty reasonable, is it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, yes, they do get a physical exam either by a physician or a nurse practitioner, and there is a medical sign-off before they're allowed in the program.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Follow-up to that point, then, so if something were to happen, even with a medical sign-off by the doc or medical or practitioner, as you're talking, and that person were to have something happen to them, the state of Minnesota is going to be liable for the health care as well, no matter what, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, as long as they're incarcerated with us, we are liable for their treatment.
By the state constitution, by the way. So, Mr. Chair, if people are comfortable with what's in the A2 amendment, I'll offer the A2 amendment.
Senator Higgins moves the A2 amendment. Is there any further question or discussion about the A2 amendment? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. The amendment is adopted. Any further questions or discussion about the Senate file 1332 as amended?
Let's jump right up there. Mr.
Chair.
Mr. Crist.
There were a few things offered in the criteria to Senator Higgins yesterday that didn't make it into the amendment, and I just want to speak to those issues very briefly. One would be that the offender had an escape history in the last 5 years from custody, absconding from a non-custody placement, or absconding from bail. Another would be maximum.
Mr. Crist, I think it's on paragraph 3 of the amendment, lines 1.6 and 1.7 makes reference to 609.485, the escape statute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Lines 1.6 and 1.7 on the amendment.
Maximum custody status. It's possible that an offender could be on maximum custody status at our Oak Park Heights prison, and if he met the other criteria, he could be admitted right from the maximum security facility to what amounts to a minimum security program. Offenders will attain maximum custody status generally because of very poor conduct in the facility, including assaults on staff or making threats or fights with other offenders. So we felt it was important to have that criteria in there. We suggested that persons who have multiple personal offenses against the same victim, including but not limited to violation of protection orders, might not be an appropriate candidate for the program. And this is speaking to a domestic abuser, someone that is threatening or harming a domestic partner. And we thought, for reasons of public safety, that they ought not be admitted to the program. We suggested that offenders that require an end of confinement review, that's our process that defines predatory offenders as being a level 1, 2, or 3 sex offender, and maybe that's already subsumed in the statute that says that sex offenders can't be in the program.
Mr. Crist, that would be lines 1.8 and 1.9 on the amendment, paragraph 4.
People who require
so I would assume anyone that's committed to the commissioner's custody for a predatory offender offense would cover that category of those who would need that review at the end of sentence, would they not?
I would, Mr. Chairman, I would think so, yes, thank you. And then the last one that we suggested in our exclusionary criteria was, if the facts of an offender's offense met the definition of some of the excluded offenses, like, and they are murder, manslaughter, criminal sexual conduct, assault, kidnapping, robbery, arson. Every once in a while, an offender's the facts of their offense will meet some of the facts of these, but they'll plea bargain, say, from a criminal sexual conduct down to a burglary charge. And we would like to be able to look at the facts or the offense characteristics, even if they don't have that conviction, to be able to exclude them from the program in the name of public safety.
And, Mr. Chair,
Senator,
I kind of had issues with that.
if and there are way more attorneys in the room who would be able to, you know, have a more learned response to this, but I think you should be judged on what you were found guilty of, not other things. And so that's why that one didn't get included in there. And you all, as attorneys, would know better than I, but that one didn't seem right to me.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, what you want to be careful of is changing things that are working, and one of them relates to domestic abuse. And if you have somebody come in that's charged with domestic abuse and one of the gross misdemeanor areas, why you, you're going to have that roll over, and the police and the prosecutors won't know that this person had a thing which could have led to a higher penalty. So that's the reason why some of those exist.
Okay.
You know, there are plea bargains happen for a lot of reasons. Sometimes because the state isn't confident that they can prove the offenses,
right,
which are dismissed as part of a plea bargain,
right,
but they can prove that which there's a plea for. Which is why it results in a plea instead of a trial. So it's kind of a slippery slope to start second-guessing those processes as to why a plea bargain happened. Essentially, you're assuming facts were true that were alleged in a complaint but not proven as part of a conviction. I can see why that would be excluded. Senator Berglund, you had a question?
I agree with you.
That comment's always welcome.
Mr. Chairman, I also think the same thing is true for violation of an order for protection. I mean, in this day and age, order for protections are issued for a wide variety of reasons. I mean, they don't necessarily have to do with domestic abuse even. And so, you know, I kind of feel like maybe somebody that violated an order for protection sometime in their life might be a very good candidate.
Senator Berglund, I can't hear you.
Someone who violated an order for protection might be a very good candidate for this program. I don't think it should automatically disqualify somebody.
There's also a piece of the violation could take a lot of different forms. Multiple telephone calls when the order for protection prohibits contact, or text messages, would be a violation, and that might not necessarily be a reason why you want to exclude them from this kind of a program. A repeated assault would probably result in new charges in addition to an OFP violation. And sometimes, and this is an idea that came to me from another prosecutor, sometimes those contacts that are prohibited are initiated by the victim, and then when the defendant responds to the victim-initiated contact, it's the defendant that ends up being charged with the violation of the no-contact order or the order for protection. I've actually had a bill proposed, I didn't introduce it, that would say if that were the scenario, then you couldn't charge the violent with the order for protection violation. But that's it gets into a lot of different fact scenarios. I agree with Senator Berglund. Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Can I disagree?
Of course.
That person still made a pretty bad choice whether he was coerced into it or not. So I just wanted to make that point.
And, Mr. Chair, on the issue of the, call it the maximum something or another. I think that the existing statute would probably knock most of those folks out. You know, the language that's been on the books for 20 or more years, murder, manslaughter, all those kinds of things. If I understand it correctly, I think they wouldn't be eligible anyway.
Mr. Christ, you were commenting that there might be some that weren't in for those categories but might have engaged in conduct while in custody that would move them into maximum custody status. Is that?
Mr. Chairman, yes. A fella can be incarcerated, a man or a woman could be incarcerated for one of the charges that aren't listed in the statute is making them ineligible and have horrible conduct in the facility, to and including assaulting staff or other offenders, fighting, threatening people, and attain that maximum custody status.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Berglund?
I don't understand how the language that's in the amendment that we adopted wouldn't take care of that. I mean, it says, you know, if you have disciplinary confinement time added to your sentence or been placed in segregation.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund.
If you have a suspended formal disciplinary sanction, you know, it seems like it's taken care of in here.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, an offender can remain on maximum custody beyond the time that he fulfills his disciplinary sanction.
Mr. Christ, it looks like the amendment language here doesn't say that only while they're under disciplinary confinement, but if they have had disciplinary confinement time added or have been placed in segregation. So simply the status of having had that occur while they're in custody would disqualify them from the program. As I read the amendment, maybe Mr. Backus can be a little more clear.
Mr. Chair, members, I believe you look on line 1.14, it would be unless 90 days have elapsed from the imposition of the added time or the last day of segregation. So it is modified by that.
So they get cleared after 90 days of good behavior? Or
Mr. Chairman, okay. Yes.
Okay, and that's your concern, is if they've got a history but they've gone past their 90-day period, you still don't want them eligible?
Mr. Chairman, yes, there are going to be cases that we wouldn't want to place into a minimum security program.
Okay, well, this will be laid over for possible inclusion, and so
we can keep working.
We can certainly
it,
consider that in the final version. Is there any further discussion, questions, or comments?
If not, Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 1332, as amended, be recommended to pass and be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Public Safety Bill.
Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 1332, as amended, be recommended, pass, and laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Bill. Any further questions or discussion on this bill? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you all. Members, for the rest of the afternoon, we wanted to have a discussion about the bill that the Judiciary Policy Committee sent to us with policy changes that would have an effect on budgets. The first two articles of the bill belong in Senator Foley's division. So the things that would come to us would be Article 3, starting on page 20. And I thought I would have Mr. Backus talk to us about...
Does this bill have a number?
2018. Okay. Right. We've got the Senate Council document. Senator Moy introduced it today as Senate File 2018. But they should be the same document. It's just a different number. We put this together in the Judiciary Committee, so it was kind of a committee bill as a way to get the...
So is it the SC6935C?
Yes. So, Mr. Backus, would you walk us through these, please?
Certainly, Madam Chair. And again, to reiterate, it's the SC6935CE1 document, which was sent to the revisor's office reflecting the committee bill that the Judiciary Committee approved and is being introduced by Senator Moy. There's also a summary in people's packets of the entire bill. And, yeah, we'll begin with Article 3, which is on page 20 of the CE1 document and page 4 of the summary. And as Senator Higgins said, these are the changes that relate to items within this division's budget. The first half of Article 3, sections 1 through 16, all make changes to the controlled substances laws. And then the second half make changes to other provisions. So then beginning with sections 1 to 3, these sections add new definitions to the Controlled Substances Chapter of Law. Section 1 defines small amount as it applies to cocaine, heroin, or methamphetamine as being 0.1 grams or less. This definition is relevant for sections 13 to 15, which we'll get to in a little bit. Section 2 then defines aggravating factor for the controlled substance law, and that definition is going to be relevant for sections 4, 5, 7, and 8. Section 3 adds a definition of marijuana plant for the controlled substances law, and this definition is going to be relevant for sections 5, 8, 10, and 13. Beginning then on page 21 with the substantive changes, section 4, sections 4 and 5 amend the first degree controlled substances crime. Section 4 is the sales crime, and section 5 is the possession crime. What these sections do and other sections that are going to follow are they make changes. They increase the threshold amounts for cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamine crimes. The section 4 change is, again, for sales, and it increases the threshold for those items from 10 grams to 40 grams. Section 5 amends the thresholds for possession of those substances from 25 grams to 100 grams. Both sections retain the current threshold levels, but would apply them only if two or more aggravating factors were present at the time of the offense. And you'll remember aggravating factors. We talked about that in Section 2 of the bill. Section 5 also amends the possession crime, the first-degree possession crime, to include the possession of marijuana plants. And Section 5 makes it first-degree possession for a person to unlawfully possess 100 or more marijuana plants. Sections 6, 9, 11, 12, 14, and 33 amend the provisions of the Controlled Substances Law, first through fifth degree, that apply a mandatory minimum sentence for persons who commit a subsequent offense. Under current law, those mandatory minimums apply. They're anywhere from 4 years in prison for first degree down to 6 months in local jail for a fifth degree offense. That takes us to sections 7 and 8. And 7 and 8 amend the second degree controlled substances crime. 7 is the sales and 8 is the possession. They make similar changes to what we did in sections 4 and 5. They increase the threshold amounts for cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamine crimes. The Section 7 sales threshold is increased from 3 grams to 10 grams, and Section 8's possession threshold goes from 6 grams to 25 grams. Similar to Sections 4 and 5, they retain the current threshold amounts if there are two or more aggravating factors present. And then Section 8 also adds a marijuana plant possession crime if one possesses 50 or more marijuana plants. Section 10 amends the third-degree controlled substances possession crime, and it increases the threshold amount for cocaine, heroin, or methamphetamine from 3 grams to 6 grams or more. In this instance, the concept of aggravating factors is not present, so those are only for first- and second-degree crimes. And then Section 10 also makes it a third-degree possession crime for a person to possess 25 or more marijuana plants. Section 13 and 15 are related, and they relate to the small amount definition for cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamine that we talked about in Section 1. Currently, a person who possesses even a trace amount of those substances could be charged with a fifth-degree possession crime, which is a 5-year felony. 13 on lines 26.23 basically exempt out small amounts of cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamine from the fifth-degree possession crime and would create in Section 15 a brand-new misdemeanor penalty for a small amount of possession of cocaine, heroin, or methamphetamine. Section 13 also adds to the fifth-degree possession crime a marijuana plant possession for 10 plants or more. That takes us to Section 16, and Section 16 amends the current provisional law providing for stays of adjudication for persons who possess small amounts, low-level drug offenses. And under current law, it's permissive. This would make it presumptive and would require a court to either give the stay of sentence of adjudication or provide in writing why the possession, why the stay of adjudication wouldn't be appropriate, and state substantial and compelling reasons why it would be inappropriate. Then we leave the controlled substances law and we go to the DWI law. Sections 17 to 19 and 21 are basically conforming changes that are related to the substantive changes in Section 20. Section 20 amends the felony DWI law, the sentencing provision. Under current law, a sentencing judge is required to impose a three-year sentence on a felony DWI offender. The judge is authorized to stay the execution of the sentence, but not its imposition. That requirement is being stricken in Section 20. In addition, the current requirement that the Commissioner of Corrections cannot release an offender under the early release provisions of the Challenge Incarceration Program unless the person has successfully completed chemical dependency treatment. That requirement is being stricken in Section 20 as well. Section 22 repeals the current mandatory minimum sentence that's applicable to violations of the Predatory Offender Registration Law. Sections 23 to 28, 30 and 31 amend the laws addressing the sentence of how long a person would stay a minimum amount in jail or prison. This is sometimes talked about as the good time law. Currently, offenders are required to serve a minimum of two-thirds of their executed sentences. These sections would change that from two-thirds down to 60% of the executed sentence. The next change is Section 29, and Section 29 places a 90-day cap on the amount of time the Commissioner of Corrections can incarcerate a first-time supervised release violator following the revocation of the supervised release. So it would be a 90-day cap, and it does not apply to sex offenders. And then finally, Section 32 is related to, I think it was the Section 20 change on the felony DWI law, and it requests the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission to re-rank the felony offense at a lower severity level.
Thank you, Mr. Backus. Senator Mois, you've introduced this bill. Is there anything you'd like to add at this point?
Madam Chair, the bill was jacketed, and I think it was dropped in today, so it should be in tomorrow's introductions.
And members, we were charged with cutting $78 million out of the public safety budget for our target. And in looking at our spreadsheets, it was clear to us that we can't get there without making some policy changes that affect how and when people go to prison and then the point at which they can think about getting out onto probation. So these are a lot of provisions related to that. And as we go through the process of putting our bill together, we can consider these. These have been sent to us from the policy committee. We can reject them if we want to as well, but we've got a big honking number. Yesterday, we were told that we were going to be getting $30 million out of the federal money, the stimulus money. So we're down to only $43 million that we have to cut, which is really good news. But that's still just a humongous amount of money for our division. So this was an effort to try to give us a few more options. Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you. And I don't know if this is appropriate this time or not, but is there a fiscal note attached to this? Do you know how many beds we'll save or how many dollars?
Mr. Turner, you want to give us an update?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Ingebritson. There's a fiscal note that has been requested, and about a half hour before the hearing, I got the numbers from Sentencing Guidelines, which is what everybody else bases their calculations on. So the note will be done by next week. What I have is I had a memo that I put together based on preliminary analysis. Now that I've got sentencing guidelines, though, Madam Chair, I was thinking I could reform or rewrite the memo. There isn't much of a difference, but I can use the actual numbers from the note and distribute that to the committee members tomorrow, if that would be okay.
And then Monday we're going to be discussing this as well, so you know we can
take
have it
any
on
action today then at all.
We're not going to take any action on this.
Sure.
No.
Thank you.
So I think it would Monday be fine just to have it available for us on Monday?
Okay.
Give you a little time. Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, I'm glad to hear that you got some one-time federal dollars. That being said, though, I think that it would be short-sighted for us to think that somehow that one-time federal dollars has alleviated us of the obligation to look at the long-term structural deficit that we have in place and the continuing impact that's going to have on this division's budget. So I think that the one-time federal dollars has helped to soften the blow a little bit this budget cycle, but I think it's important for us to take into consideration some of these suggestions, not necessarily within the short-sightedness of the short term, but also I guess in the permanent changes or permanent restructuring that we need to look at for the out years.
Senator Wai, you're right, because our target for the next biennium, which we're supposed to balance now by the bill that we passed earlier this year, is back to 78 or 79 million. So even though we've got help for this biennium, we've got a significant problem for the next one. You're absolutely right. Senator Latz?
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm afraid I had to step out while Mr. Backus was reviewing this. I'm trying to catch up. Was there any... I think the fax filing fee is a function of court rules. Is it not a function of state statute, or is there something in here on that?
You're looking at either Article 1 or Article 2, and this division has Article 3.
Only Article 3 in this division?
Yes, divisions one or Articles 1 and 2 are in Senator Foley's division, and we'll start looking at those whenever Senator Foley says, but those are court fees and a lot of related things there, too. You might be interested in the controlled substances provisions that came to us were considered in the controlled substance working group that worked all last interim, and so that's where those came from.
So, Madam Chair, on that point,
does
this bill adopt any certain group of those recommendations? I mean, there were, I think, four categories, one of which was labeled like the judge's option or something like that. Is that the one that's adopted in this?
Senator Lass, it was the judge's option that we put in here. Okay. That was kind of the middle range.
Yes.
Madam Chair, with the exception of the marijuana grow provisions from the prosecutors.
Yes, any other discussion on this? Is there anybody in the audience who wants to talk to us about this a little bit? We will be having a further discussion on next Monday about it. But we have a little time.
What action is expected to be taken on Monday?
Do we actually have to vote to lay it over? We don't have to, do we? Okay. Mr. Backus says that we can amend it if we want, or we can just consider that it's here in our division for action, for inclusion into our omnibus bill, if we choose to do so. I don't think we actually have to take a vote on it.
And, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, would we then only potentially include Section 3 in the omnibus bill, and Sections 1 and 2 would be separately in Senator Foley's division?
Yes, and traditionally when we go off to negotiate with the House and Conference Committee, Senator Foley's bill and our bill join together, because in the House those jurisdictions are all in one division. So we'll join back up together after usually after we present them on the floor for sending them off to conference committee.
Okay.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To understand it correctly, then we can do amendments on Monday?
Sure.
Yeah, okay. Not today.
Not today.
Right.
Monday's better. Hello.
Hello.
Go right ahead. Who'd ever like to start?
I'll start. Madam Chair, my name is Lynn Dingle. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. I would like to start about Section 23, where it starts talking about the 60-40 proposal, the amount of good time. I just want to reiterate that the Department of Corrections continues to have concerns about public safety with the amount of people that will be let out on early release status. We don't have the low-level, non-dangerous offenders in our prison system. In some preliminary research that we did, the average time cut for our existing offenders that are not release violators is going to be about 13 months that they're going to be cut in their sentence. And breaking that down a little bit further, about 1,400 offenders will be let out anywhere from 1 year beyond 10 years early of their sentence under this bill. Another little breakdown is that over 60% of those offenders will get more than a 90-day time cut. So we do have concerns about the type of offenders that will be released early.
Well, just to be clear, this is a 7% cut from 60, two-thirds, 66 or 67 for rounding, to 60. And it kind of fit with my 7% cut I had to do. Does anybody know, Senator, former Senator Tennyson's in the back, and maybe you know, or maybe one of the testifiers at the table know. At some point, the state made the decision to go down to 67%. Does anybody know kind of when that might have been? I'm sure that in some other budget crisis in years past, this number went, this proportion went from, you know, maybe it was at 80-20 at some point or 90-10 at some point, and at some point it got to 67%. I don't know if anybody knows the history of that. Okay. Mm-hmm. Just asked.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, on that point.
Yes.
It is sort of standard, and I don't have the history, but it is sort of standard to give one-third off for good behavior when someone's in custody. So it may be that that sort of one-third reference point was the initial provision that went into law. Although for state prison, if you don't just get the time off, you get it, the in-custody portion reduced, and then you're released down in supervision.
Mm-hmm.
But it might be that that one-third was the starting point. I don't know the specific history, though.
I know that Iowa is at 50-50, and other states are at other percentages, but our good neighbor to the south is at 50-50. So, Commissioner Bray?
Thank you. Chris Bray, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Corrections, Madam Chair, members. I'd like to ask you to consider one thing related to the 90-day cap. As you know, that currently excludes sex offenders. I wonder if you would consider also excluding offenders on intensive supervised release. I know that will reduce the cost savings a little bit because that will mean another group of offenders exempted from the 90-day. But I think one of the possible unintended consequences, and I don't know this for sure, of the 90-day is that when agents are supervising some of the really heavy-duty offenders, they often informally restructure and sanction before they say, okay, I've had it, I'm going to call hearings and release. And one of the things we've wondered is if this would, if agents would say, okay, now they're only going to get 90 days the first time, I think I have a really serious guy here. I really am trying to prevent future victims, so I think I'll violate him right off the bat. Again, it's just speculation. But the other reason that I ask you to consider is that those offenders on intensive supervised release, that really is about victim, not re-victimizing the victim or not creating more victims. So I would just ask you to consider that as you move this along.
Okay, thank you. Good input is good input. Thank you. Commissioner Dingle, anything else? Thank you. Right. Anybody else who wants to give us a comment at this point?
I have a question for Commissioner Dingell.
Sure. Senator Lance.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, you were mentioning it might reduce their time in custody by 90 days to up to a year. Is that what I heard you to say, depending on which?
Madam Chair, Senator Lance, actually a good percentage, over 20% or about 20%, would get from anywhere from 1 year to over 10 years of a time cut under this bill.
Okay, and can you tell me if a change of 7% of their sentence is 10 years, you're talking about a 70-year sentence, which I don't know too many people who are given 70-year sentences. Can you give me some idea of where the bell curve hits on this?
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm not sure I understand your question, but the bell curve is the 13 months. Because we have such a great variety in sentence lengths, that, you know, excluding lifers, but some people get the 40-year sentence, or they may have consecutive sentences. But that's what the stats show, is that about 100 people currently in our system that are not release violators have 10 years or more of a sentence cut under this provision.
Which means they would have served how many years?
I'm sorry, I don't have that information.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, that's pretty important
it's
information.
Not right.
Well,
it doesn't sound right to me to start it, either, but if they're serving 50 years and they get out after 40 years instead, I'm less concerned than if they're serving 20 years and they're getting out in 10 years instead.
And Commissioner Dingell, if this is a 7% cut, so if your sentence was 100 years, you'd get 7 years off. So I don't know how you got to that giant number, but somebody's math is off.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm more than willing to talk with someone afterwards and get to the bottom of this. I didn't prepare this, so I really can't answer the question. I'm sorry.
Thank you. We'll keep working on trying to get the right information, and that would be great. Thanks. Okay. Senator Ma, you look like you have a puzzled look on your face.
No, it's just that, Madam Chair, we have really great staff who have been working really hard at the department to try to get us all the numbers that we need. And going forward, I understand the commissioner's position. The commissioner has to maintain a position that she absolutely cannot let anybody out. At least that's been the position she's maintained in this committee from the beginning of the legislative session. And the staff has to represent the numbers that they have to represent. But we're not just talking hypotheticals now. We have, I think, made some really hard decisions to say, instead of talking hypotheticals and putting some numbers together, we have said, you know what, we're going to actually put some language into form and put it on the table for discussion and use that as a starting point. And so I hope that, and I know that the great and smart and professional staff who are working with us, as difficult as this may be, I hope that they will be, they will know that nobody makes these kind of propositions just for the fun of it. Nobody. And it is because not only the direness of the fiscal situation that we're in, but there's actually, if anybody bothered to listen to the testimonies in the policy committee, that there's actually some good policy rationale behind some of these proposals for why we should rethink about doing some of the things we're doing a little bit differently. And I found it persuasive when the two professors from the University of Minnesota Law School testified to say, you know, at some point, the return on how long you incarcerate somebody diminishes. It actually diminishes. So what, 50 years versus 40 years? What's the added value of an additional 10 years on that individual? In all honesty. And so I hope that given that as a starting point and given the discussions that we've had in the policy committee, that we will have an opportunity, Madam Chair, to take advantage of the really great professional staff that we have at the department to get the proper numbers in gear and give us an opportunity to really look at, in terms of the numbers, what this proposal represents before we dismiss it
as if somehow this is abdicating our responsibility on public safety. Because I think that there is an opportunity here where we could actually make good public policy that does not compromise public safety and still get the budget savings that we need.
Eloquently said. Thank you so very much. Let me tell you what the plan for the next several meetings are. Monday we'll have some bills and continue the discussion on Senator Moore's bill. And then we will have our budget bill, and then we have, you know, Easter Passover break. And when we come back on April 15th, which is, that's a Wednesday, we will have our budget bill here for us to take action on. Because we've been told that we're presenting it in big finance on the 17th, which is Friday. So Easter break is going to be difficult to work around, but that's how we're planning to do it. And we have, like I said, a big number to hit, both for this biennium and the out years. So we have a lot of good thinking and acting that we need to do. So there's a plan. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Madam Chair, let's back up a little. Where did this number come from?
Where did what number come from?
The $78 million. Is that the first proposal by the governor? Is that right?
No. This is the Senate's proposal. Remember, we were given targets, budget targets of 7% across the board. Okay. And to this division, that was $78 million. And then yesterday, we were given a little reprieve and got a $30 million taken off of that number. So we're now at 4 point something. So I did a lot of whining and carrying on to try to get people to understand how difficult that cut is in this division at 7%. So that's what we'll go forward now. In the House, for negotiating purposes, they're at about 3.5%. So we have, at the end of the day, we have three different numbers. We have the governor's number, we have the House number, we have the Senate number. But as far as I know now, this is the number we'll go into conference committee with. It's the 48? 43? Whatever. No, what is that number? 78 minus 30. Yeah, 48. So Mr. Turner.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members, I think a better way to look at it is, not a better way, but another way to look at it is we have to cut $78 million in general fund dollars from our general fund-based budget. And then we're getting a one-time temporary backfill in federal grants of $30 million. So we'll have a net cut of $48 million this biennium. Those federal grants go away for the next biennium, so we have a tails problem, a general fund tails problem of $78 million for the following biennium. Which means that if we just cut stuff, $48 million, say, from the only place we can cut it, corrections and public safety, we just can't, you know, straight line it across into the next biennium because the Senate and the House both passed bills and said we have to balance in 12 and 13. That's why some of these proposals for beds are going to look very, as from a budgeting perspective, they're going to look very appealing. Because they will take care of the tails for you. The savings on those provisions go up through the years. First year, say, a provision, I've got it here and I'll have it for you, you know, 22 beds, second year, 40 beds, third year, you know, 70 beds. And when you're talking some of the big stuff, like 60-40 or the 90-day release violator, you're talking hundreds of beds. So the bed provisions are going to be very attractive for taking care of the tails problem.
So, Madam Chair.
Here's your last.
So, for purposes of our division's budget, we really have two options. We can either just cut the direct appropriations to the departments, or we can make policy changes that are going to result in savings.
Or both.
Or a combination of the two. And so what we looked at here in Section 3 of this bill was the proposed policy changes to accomplish savings that would. And what portion of the $48 million would those policy changes accomplish? Would that be all of it, or would we also be separately also be cutting the direct appropriations to the departments too?
Well, we don't have the fiscal note back yet for Senator Moore's bill, but and that will tell us, but I think it's safe to say that it does not get us to $48 million in any way, shape, or form. Am I right?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Letts, if we took all of them and we closed down Moose Lake or Faribault or Lino Lakes, one of the three medium security prisons.
Because we saved enough beds to do that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Then we'd come up with our cut. I think closing down, for example, Moose Lake would net maybe, and that would include, you have to think, severance, a realistic drawdown timetable, and mothballing costs, and you might net $40 million for the biennium. So then you'd still have to go after pass-through grants, administrative costs of the Department of Corrections, pass-through grants of the Department of Public Safety, BCA cuts, which are agents, forensic scientists, or tech personnel for the MNSIS, for the Criminal Justice Information System. So it's quite a task.
And given the nature of the clientele in our division, you can't really get those fees there. So we don't have those non-tax increase options to generate revenue for this division either, if we were considering fee increases. It's just not available unless, except in that tiny Department of Human Rights, I suppose, where you could charge a fee for everyone. I'm not saying I'm advocating this, I'm just thinking out loud. A fee for everyone involved for discrimination. But I don't like that idea at all. But that's the only place I can see it.
Yeah. The options that might be available in other divisions just kind of aren't in ours. So you're right.
There were other options that were under consideration as a part of the policy changes that not have been proposed in here. Are we also going to have available to us a list of what those options were so we can consider those too?
Some were taken out in the policy committee. We had a proposal, for example, that would have put the felony DWI level from the fourth offense to the fifth, and that was felt to be not acceptable to the policy committee. So, for instance, that left the original bill. I can't remember what else went away, but Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, member, if I remember correctly, they related more to the other articles, but one was the suspension for 2 years of the harassment restraining order law, and the other was when your amendment to eliminate, say, low-level theft from the conversion of misdemeanor to a petty, but those are the big three, I would say. And
Madam Chair, a couple of amendments were added in the policy committee also. I think that the marijuana grow provision took away some savings when we added that.
Yeah, I think Senator Ortman had about six amendments that day.
Yes.
So. Senator Ingridson, and then I think we'll wrap it up.
Thank you. Just a comment. We do have another option, do we not? As we got together with the policy committee and budget committee, and after hearing all the testimony and all the good work that's gone on, as you referred to earlier, the DWI law was talked about two weeks ago here. The 30% third off for good behavior, that there was a lot of work that went into that. Maybe we should all just stand up and say, no, we think public safety is a real priority for us all, and we're not going to cut anything.
You know, I don't think that's the way the Minnesota Senate works.
Okay.
I've had a lot of conversations with a lot of people with a lot more power than I have around here, and was very pleased to get the $30 million cut. But, I think at the point at which we negotiate with the other two legs of the stool, so to speak, there will be another number that will appear, and that'll be the number that we put together, and that'll be an agreement with the House and the Governor. And
But at this point, I don't know that we're going to, I don't know that we can just say, no, we're not going to do this.
Okay.
Nobody's ever told me I could do that anyway. Senator Moore.
Well, Madam Chair, you know, Senator Ingrid-Britson makes a good point that that is certainly an option that we can go. I don't know about this committee, but certainly part of the reason why the policy committee went the route that we did, which is rather unusual, was not because I have a burning desire to carry a particular kind of a bill, if you've been reading the headlines. But I think it is a responsible thing to face the reality of what we're going to have to face. And at the end of the day, I think it's important to put these provisions out there for the public to give us some input. Because at the end of the day, I would rather we do this in the light of day during the legislative session when the public can still give us input than for us to be irresponsible about it during the legislative policymaking process. Just say we're going to stand firm and we're not going to make any cuts. And come the end of May or whatever it is, we're handed a cut that we have to make. And at that point, we don't have an opportunity to have input from either the public or from the professionals who are running this process. So, you know, I thought that in the policy committee discussion the other day, Commissioner Ellison was so eloquent when she said, when we said, well, given a 7% cut, what would you cut? And Commissioner Ellison said, you know, Madam Chair, why don't you suggest to us what you think might happen, and then we'll come back to you with some feedback on what we think might happen, and that's the way we ought to work. And I agree that I think if we're going to be responsible about looking at, ultimately, I think it would be irresponsible for us to assume that somehow public safety is going to be held harmless in this budgeting process. I don't know where that percentage is going to be, but I think that the process of making this painful at the front end allows the public and the professional people who are involved in this work to help us prioritize where we ought to be looking at. And I think that that process, in the end, will help this division a lot to say some things are just – we're just not going to go there. But if we must, then we've had the proper input from the professionals and from the public to say if we must, then this is the areas that we should go. And I think it would be irresponsible of us if we didn't forewarn the public and we didn't create the opportunity for that prioritization to take place. So I for one, would like to be where you're at, Senator Ingrid-Britson, to say we will not play that game. It's too important for us, and we will not. We refuse. But I think that's – I don't think that that's being –
That's not a motion.
I don't think the public will buy that. And at the end of the day, I think we will lose an opportunity to have the public participate with us in what we end up having to do to them. And I think that half of what we do is managing people's expectations. The other half is just to send the signal and to let people know what's going to be happening. And I think we need to do that, especially in public safety, because it really – that's where it matters to a lot of people.
Just, thank you, ma'am. Just one quick thing. Just they do send us here to do this job, and I don't think we're going to have a time – any kind of time for the public to review this and get back to us. We have to make this decision ourselves. That's where we're sent here. And I'm just of the mindset that public safety is important enough not to cut, and I think – at least I know my public feels that way, and I think there's an awful lot that do as well. So that's just my input for what it's worth. Thanks.
And we have lots of people who will say that education is their most important one.
Healthy.
Or health care.
Exactly.
You know, and that's the balance that we all have to try to do here at the Capitol, is try to come up with, I mean, it's all in all, it's a $7 billion problem we have here.
And on that point, Madam Chair, I think that if you weren't the budget chair of this division and you had to put out a budget representing the Senate, you, like me, would be exactly where Senator Ingrid-Britson is, which is that if it were up to me and I'm not a budget chair, I would say that's also exactly where I want to be, because it is very important to all the people that we represent. And I think that you and I have the luxury to do that because our names are not on a budget division and we don't have to put a budget together. But at the end of the day, I think that to the degree that we can help to stimulate that conversation on where the priority is going to be and manage the public's expectation, I also think that that's part of our job.
Senator Lax.
I also think it's incumbent upon those who would not make any cuts to determine where the revenue is going to come from to make up the difference, because we have a shortfall of revenue compared to projected expenditures. So if you don't cut here, you either cut either somewhere else or you're bringing new revenue somewhere else.
I think if you want to hold fast to one category, I think to be intellectually consistent, you have to propose how you're going to handle the other categories, too.
It is a balancing game at the end of the day.
Sure it is. It's priorities. It's called priorities.
Sure it is.
And we're down to that right now. So.
Great. Thank you, everybody, for participating today. This was a good discussion. We're adjourned. See you Monday.